Zeus's altar is what John is referencing when he talks about Satan's throne. It's the same thing.
This is the question. What is a Satan? Because it's not actually a person.
Baal, actually he's Zeus, and actually Zeus is Jupiter, and actually Jupiter is...
Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled, where we're pulling back the curtain to look at the hidden parts of our Bibles. It's not because God hides them, it's often because we're ashamed of them and culture doesn't know what to do with them. But we think they're for God's glory and the advancement of the gospel. So today, our two pastors, Doug Van Dorn, who's the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado, and I'm John Moffitt, I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And for you, it's only been a week, but for Doug and I, it's been a couple weeks. We've been traveling and sickness and here and there, so it was good to get caught back up and talk about today's subject. We're continuing to work through the episode. If you found us randomly on YouTube or on a podcast, and this is your first episode, we encourage you to go back and to listen to the earlier episodes. We're kind of setting up the worldview, thinking about gods and demons and the spiritual warfare that happens with the divine council. And we're going to be building on that today and adding to the characters. And we've talked about angels, we've talked about demons, and now we're going to be talking about Satan. So before we get into it, Doug, it's good to be with you this morning.
Let's have some fun, man.
Yeah. Anything new in your life? Anything exciting happening?
You know, it's fall. The world's going to go crazy this month. So I don't need anything new in my life.
So did you just say politics? That's a pretty good segue to, are we talking about Satan today?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, sorry. Boom. I always say, is this not a podcast on politics, or is it? Satan. What is Satan? Often, kind of like angels and demons. I feel like we've done some clarity on, okay, what is an angel? Angel's a title. What is a demon? It's kind of like where it comes from. Most people think it was fallen angels, but it's not. It's they come from the dead Nephilim. Go back and listen to that episode. And I think we're here to shed some light and maybe reconstruct some views of Satan. And we're going to start in the Old Testament too. Like, why can't we see the word Satan, or do we? And why is it Satan the being in there? So, Doug, let's start with what is not necessarily a person. This is the question. What is a Satan? Because it's not actually a person. So, what's a Satan?
Okay, so Satan is it's a word that just means an accuser. That's all it means. So it's really a function. What you actually find with a lot of these supernatural entities is that they are their functions. Angel is a messenger. Satan is an adversary. Devil is an accuser. So you can actually have more than one entity that would be any of those things. We have like ontologized. I don't know. Is that a good word? Ontologized. We've turned these functional words into words of being, so that they actually describe entities, a certain kind of entity. That's the way that we think about them, right? So an angel then becomes not necessarily a human, even though the Bible has human messengers, human angels, but we only think heavenly beings. We do the same thing with Satan. So if somebody was to hear that there's multiple Satans, they would freak out because they're like, no, there's only one Satan, and it's the great adversary of God. Well, there is a character in the Bible, and especially the New Testament, that is called Satan, that we have turned into a proper name, and we're trying to discover who he is. That's kind of what the point of this show is going to be. But Satan is a title that's used for the angel of the Lord, for example. He's called the adversary of Balaam. When he stands in the way and the donkey starts talking, he's actually called the Satan. And so nobody would say that the angel of the Lord is Satan. Like, if you say that, if you're thinking that the angel of the Lord is Satan, then you got a big problem. So that's not
basically you're saying Jesus is Satan.
Yeah, that's basically what it would be. So that would be kind of a heresy, I would have to say. there's a figure in Job chapter 1 and 2, right? He comes with the sons of God into the heavenly realm with God, and Satan is there. So you'll get a lot of Old Testament scholars will say, well, that's not Satan. It shouldn't be capitalized. It's a Satan. It's an accuser. And there was actually a function on the Divine Council in the ancient Near East that was basically the prosecuting attorney of the divine courtroom. And that prosecuting attorney was called the Satan. And so people will say, well, this is not Satan, Satan. This is just a Satan whose job here now is to prosecute Job and to try and find him guilty before the court of heaven. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. In that particular instance, I don't really care if it's the Satan or a Satan. It doesn't really matter to me. About the only other time I think that we find the word translated as Satan with a capital S is in either the Chronicles or the Kings. It's where David is numbering his mighty men. He gets in trouble for it. And one of the two books says that the Lord incited him, and the other one says that Satan did. Now, in that case, you could say, just like with Balaam, that the Lord is the Satan. He's the one who is kind of behind as the first cause. What's David going to do? He's the one who, hey, David, are you going to stand or fall? Are you going to obey me or are you not going to obey me? Mm-hmm. Or it could be, you know, an alternate interpretation is that it actually is the evil one who is inciting God. So a secondary means God is using this creature or some other accuser to cause David to fall ultimately.
Yeah,
but neither one of them is really what we think of. At least we don't know 100%, or even 50%, or 10% that this is the same character that we have in the New Testament. The only other place, and this is where I would differ from a lot of Old Testament scholars, like even Dr. Heiser, Genesis 3, you have this creature there that's called the serpent, right? But I believe very strongly that John, in Revelation 12 and 20, is actually identifying that character with Satan, the one that we actually call Satan. So that's the same entity in my mind that's there with Eve, that is there who becomes the deceiver of the whole world and has been cast out of heaven and is there playing the major role in the Gospels and so on.
Yeah, so confident about definitely the garden. Could go either way on Job. What about Ezekiel and Isaiah?
Oh yeah. So, he's not called the Satan there in either one. Where you're thinking, I think of Isaiah 14, where you have the shining one, son of dawn, who seeks to set himself above the stars of God. I would say that probably is the same entity that we're talking about in the New Testament, because, the shining one has great overlaps there with the character in Genesis 3:1. Nahash. So the word Nahash, we've talked about this on an earlier episode, I think, that that as a adjective, Nahash, which as a noun means a serpent, is an adjective, it means a shining one. Mm-hmm. And so the shining one idea is the same thing that you find in Isaiah. And I would say that probably that is the Satan that we're thinking of in the New Testament. And Ezekiel 28, because he's called the cherubim who's in the garden of God and the mountain of God, that's also taking us back straight to Genesis 3. So I would think that it's probably the same entity there as well. And especially Ezekiel is talking about the king of Tyre was worshiping a certain entity that we'll get into near the end of this show. I would say really good odds that actually is the same creature.
That's right. So you can have, you can have in the Bible, you can have something that has a title and it be their identification of their name at the same time. Is that fair? Is that kind of what you're getting as far as like how John is using the, or is he using it as the great Satan? Is he still using it as a title in John, in Revelation?
Well, so I think that it does, there's no doubt it becomes a proper noun, a proper name, by the time the New Testament comes along. You see this transformation in the pseudepigrapha, the intertestamental writings, where all of a sudden, and he starts getting lots of different names, like Mastema is one of the names, or Satanel, or Samael, all kinds of different names. Belial, that comes up in writings of Paul. These are just different words that, you know, one means hostility, you know, another means this and that. They're just trying to communicate different aspects of his nature, his character, which of course is always evil, wicked, deceiver, you know, whatever. He becomes a proper name by the New Testament. most of the time that we translate it with a capital S, Satan, I think that we're right to do that. And so, you know, we just kind of go with that, I think, for the show.
So do you think we ever are given his proper name?
This is a great question. Is he Voldemort? Is he is he the one who shall not be named, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And there are people out there who think that, yeah, we actually don't know his name. Almost like if you say his name, it's so evil. It's so forbidden because he did such a horrible thing that, you know, the universe would blow up or something. I don't know what would happen. Yeah, do we know his name? So Satan is a title. That's what it is, accuser. And, you know, even in when John's talking about this, he actually uses the word accuser along with Satan as kind of a wordplay. So do we know his name? I don't know if we do or not, but he is called Satan. So we'll just go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just, well, and the reason I mentioned that is that, because there is a name that's been attributed to him in the past. And I don't know why it's like totally escaping me right now. Like his angelic name. Oh man, I'll come back to it when my coffee kicks in. All right. So Doug, when we're thinking about this character who gets, you know, some great clarity in the New Testament, why don't we see him in full view in the Old Testament? Like why is it not as clear? And why do people have a hard time maybe seeing it as clear? And this is one of the, and I'll just set this up now. This is one of the things we talked about before we hit recording, where, you know, as much as we respect a lot of Dr. Heiser's work, we would see very clearly that we need to be able to read the Bible really in reverse. Once you read it, you got to then read it in reverse and understand what we have in the new informs us of what goes on in the old. So when we're thinking about Satan in the Old Testament, we mentioned a couple of places like Job, David, and
Zechariah, the kind of the other one that comes to my mind. There's a Satan who's accusing Joshua there, right? The high priest.
Yep.
And in that case, it probably is this, it's the same character, I would argue, as the New Testament as well, because you have a very clear parallel in my mind with Jude when Michael's contending with Satan. Over the body of Moses, and he does not dare to speak a blasphemous word against him, you know, but it says the Lord accuse you. Well, that's the exact same language that you find going on in Zechariah.
Yeah. So it's safe to say that we can see the entity in certain places, the word or the title or the idea of being an accuser like Zechariah is there, but his official title and name, which the New Testament finally, you know, become, they use its dominant form isn't until the New Testament. That doesn't mean his work and his presence isn't there. And why is this important, Doug, for us to believe that Satan and his work and his presence is in the Old Testament? Why would this be a subject that we want to bring up before we lead into the New Testament?
Oh my goodness. So there's a character in the Old Testament that most people think of as an idol. And so it doesn't even actually exist. But what's interesting to me is that when you say Satan, most Christians believe that he does exist. So how interesting that you have a character that people think doesn't exist, but one who we think does exist. And what we're going to argue is that it's actually the same entity, and that he actually is everywhere in the Old Testament. And he becomes the chief supernatural adversary of Israel in the Old Testament, but he's just given a different name. So that's why this matters, because as soon as you can see what we're going to talk about here, like the entire Old Testament in terms of its supernatural worldview and who is the chief enemy of God, its people in the Old Testament, it's like,
and so who is this entity, Doug? Who is this mysterious thing and or person that you were talking about?
Well, so, you know, we've talked a lot about the divine council worldview and especially these sons of God that are over the nations. That's prerequisite for understanding what we're going to talk about here. You have to think of a couple of things in the New Testament. For example, Satan is called the prince of the air or the prince of the power of this world, that kind of an idea. And then in the temptation of Jesus, what does Satan offer to Jesus, John?
He offers them the nations. He offers them basically the world.
Yeah, all the kingdoms of the world. And how can he mm-hmm. do that if they don't belong to him?
Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting, you know, all right, I'm going to jump in here for a second. It's not a legit temptation if it isn't a legit offer. Does that make sense?
No, exactly. How can you just be tempted? All Jesus would have to say is, I already have them all. That's not a temptation. Think of something else.
Because he doesn't say, well, that's dumb. You can't offer me what doesn't belong to you. So that's ridiculous.
No,
but he doesn't do that.
Instead, he goes to one of the most supernatural psalms in the Psalter, Psalm 91, and he starts quoting it back at Satan, a psalm that someday we should do that psalm too.
Hey, maybe we just do a series on the Psalms over the next few weeks.
Because it's just, it's so power-packed with crazy stuff in it. But I think we've probably talked about this with monsters. I don't remember that psalm, but Jesus quotes that psalm back at Satan, which is totally appropriate. And in other words, the temptation is very real. And the only way I can counter it is with God's word, not with telling you that it's not a real temptation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you made an allusion to something. We jumped over it, and that's kind of my fault. But the divine counsel, for those who may, this might be their first kind of go around, or maybe have not made the connection, Doug, what is the connection that you're trying to make here with the divine counsel and the temptation of Jesus and where we're about to go with this being, that this mysterious being that we're keeping back from everybody? But why is the setup and understanding of the divine counsel important there?
Well, because if you think of your Daniel 10 and the entities that are in play in that chapter, you have Daniel trying to pray to God, and then his prayer isn't answered for 3 weeks. And then finally, the angel comes, Gabriel, and he says, look, I tried my hardest to come to you and let you know the word, but I couldn't because I was held up by the prince of Persia, the prince of Persia. And you're like, well, what in the world is that? Well, this is the entity that is in control of Persia. A couple of verses later, it talks about the Prince of Greece. Now, that makes perfect sense in Daniel, because those two world powers are going to clash and collide later on in history as part of the prophecy that comes about there, as Persia gives way to eventually Greece, and then Greece eventually gives way to Rome. But that allows you to see that there are supernatural powers, beings that are over the world. Now, if you were a dynasty of Egypt and you controlled the world, and then you're the dynasty of Assyria, then you control the world. And then you're the dynasty of Persia, the Medes, and then the Greeks, then the Romans. That dynasty at that period of time, some way that I look at it, is that as the territory shifts hands on earth, so it shifts hands in heaven. Okay, So if you're the dynasty, then you become prince of the world at that point in time. And so this is why, you know, these guys are fighting just as much up there as we seem to fight down here, because they want to be the top dog. And that's polytheism in a nutshell. It's every polytheistic religion in the world has those kind of fights, right, going on for who's going to be the high god or whatever of the pantheon.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting, is that when you start listening to other cultures talk about these fights, they are describing this very phenomenon you're talking about, where there is actual wars going on, but they just have different names to these gods and, well, different stories of how it's affected.
Yeah, there's foreshadow what we're going to talk about with Psalm 24. There's something called the Baal cycle, where two brothers are vying for power. One is the brother Yam, he's the sea, and then the other is the brother Baal. He's the storm god. His name means Lord, and Yam is the one who's like going to ascend to the right hand of the father. That he's the beloved son of the father, and this infuriates Baal. It's kind of like Loki and Thor, really, even in the way that Marvel depicts them. You know, they're brothers that are fighting for power, and so in the Baal cycle, Baal overthrows Yam with his magical weapons, and then he becomes the one who ascends to the throne. Like, it's the whole first act of the Baal cycle is enacting a war. So that's, you know, that's all we're talking about, is that when you have these supernatural entities over these places, that they are fighting just as much as the men are fighting down here on Earth.
Yeah, there's two clear fight scenes in the new and old. So you've got who does this angel have to call for to help break the deadlock fight for so many weeks?
Yeah, right? He has to call for Michael, which is so interesting, right? Because in my understanding, Michael is actually the angel of the Lord. He is actually Christ pre-incarnate, and so he's the one who nobody can thwart Michael at the end of the day if he doesn't want to be thwarted.
if you don't want to wait for our episode on that, you can go to Amazon and read Doug's book on the angel of the Lord that he co-authored. We're gonna get to it eventually if you want to wait for the audio version of us to talk about it. But then also in Jude talks about there being a war between Michael and Satan over the body of Moses.
Yeah.
So the idea, like, I know people are listening to us and like, you guys are nuts talking about Marvel like wars. I'm like, well, it's not hard to get there when you're looking at passages where it's very obvious they were in a several week locked battle. We don't even know how long the battle over the body of Moses was. It's just a reference to Jude. And this is all we're trying. I'm gonna just back out and help us as interpreters. At times, we do chapter verse fallacy, where it's like, if there's not a chapter and a verse that perfectly describes what we're looking for, then I'm not going to believe in it. Well, that's really dangerous to do, because you're not going to be Trinitarian in that way either. So just to be real careful before you fall into that. And so what Doug and I are trying to do is understand the realm, our physical realm, our nature, our sin, and the spiritual realm, and how the two interact. And the Bible does reveal this to us. And you have to use all of Scripture. So this is kind of what we're doing. We're learning a little bit about I don't think we can ever get over quote Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12 when it talks about, hey, this is something we're wrestling. We should probably be aware of what we're wrestling. So going back into this, Doug, so we're talking about there being wars and a fight for authority and a power. Okay, so this is the divine counsel, understanding that there's actually... I'm going to try and connect this all together. So we have multiple scenes, Zechariah, Job, Daniel, or even in 2 Kings, where you have a council, a throne room, and you have an adversary, or they're working together on deciding what's going to happen. So this is not foreign to us, and that they're even being like in Zechariah, that there's a Satan there, there's an opposer there, an accuser there. Then we're looking at there being spiritual wars, which then creates a fight for a region. And then this, now you're connecting this to Jesus and his temptation. Am I connecting this all well together?
Yeah. Okay. So what we're trying to see is that Satan is offering Jesus all the kingdoms of the world, and it begs the question: well, how can he do that? Where did he get the kingdoms of the world? If Jesus is God, how come he doesn't have the kingdoms of the world?
Right.
Right. And so to me, the divine counsel is the only thing that makes sense of this. Like, I suppose you could say that, well, Jesus had them all in eternity past or something. And then when he emptied himself and became one of us, he kind of let that go. Maybe that answers that side of it, but it certainly doesn't answer the side of, where did Satan get the kingdoms? How come he has the right to them?
That's right.
What does that even mean? Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, this is the only thing that makes any sense whatsoever of that question.
Right.
So that's go ahead.
He's the ruler of this world.
Yeah. Right? He's the God ruler of this world. The God of this world. Let's use the word God, because we've talked about the God before, right? Mm-hmm. That people don't think there are such things. That's what Paul says. He's the God of this world. The mm-hmm. Elohim, if you were going to use the Hebrew of this world, that's what he is. That's his title. So therefore it makes sense that he would have the kingdoms, but we still haven't explained how that can really be yet.
Right. Well, and I want to point out in that phrase, and I think that maybe for people who struggle with the concept of there being multiple gods, that where we're going next might be the entry point for you, where it could help solidify, because it's not typically when we think about gods, we think about them as these objects that we fantasize power into, like we create a power in our own minds, this is like almost like, I've never put it this way before, Doug, but it's like a placebo effect, right? we want it to be powerful, therefore it is. Do you remember those balance bracelets back in the early 2000s that all the sports, they had like the little hologram on them? No, not those. There was an actual, it was like a little hologram in it, and it was rubber, and it went around your arm. Like it was big in the baseball movement. I don't know if you remember this.
No, I think the Cure that I'm wearing is like probably the closest I can remember.
Yeah. So there was like this, you know, special hologram that went in there, and it would create like this chi, like energetic, using the forces of the universe to create like this balance.
That's just exactly what the Cure is. That's what they all said on there. And like, this is 25 years old, by the way. And it actually helped me when I was loading trucks. I couldn't believe it. I injured both my wrists. And so I'm like, I got to try something. So
yeah,
I ordered them and I'm like, wow, holy cow. It actually worked on my wrist. So
there
it's the same principle, but yeah.
But this, yeah, it's the same idea. Anyways, what they come to find out was that it was improving certain people's performance, mm-hmm. but it had nothing to do with the bracelet. It was a total placebo effect. And this is what we think about the gods.
Yeah.
That, I totally got sidetracked on that one. That
Cure, by the way, did get sued for like millions and millions of dollars for the same thing.
Millions for it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they went under. It was a fascinating documentary. I'll have to go find it, but I think it was on Netflix. But this is what we think about the gods. And when I think about it in this way, Paul does not describe it as a placebo effect. He says, we're preaching the gospel. We're out there preaching the gospel. This is, you know, 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And coming up behind us is Satan, the god of this world. And it says he's blinding their eyes so they cannot see and hear the gospel. And he writes this so they would not be discouraged. Well, I don't think inanimate objects that people project in a placebo effect upon themselves, he would have to then say it was their sinful nature that's doing it. Oh, their depravity that was doing it, which you and I would believe in depravity, but I think there's a both and going on here. And so you have Jesus who's interacting with Satan. Paul calls him the god of this world, who's doing a blinding effect, but this is not the only work that he's doing. There's other work that he's doing that he gets a certain title by Jesus and in the Old Testament. So we're going to stop playing around here and we'll finally get there. So
let me give one more play around in the New Testament, because it's a parallel to the God of this world. It's a John 12.
Mm-hmm.
Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out.
Yeah.
So that's the ESV, but the word there is actually the archon. And so this is the very same word in Greek that the Septuagint translates as in Daniel 10. For these prince of Persia. So I like the translation prince of this world better than ruler of this world. They both convey something slightly different, but it's a parallel to God of this world and what we see with in 2 Corinthians with Paul. And that connects Satan directly to these princes, because he's called the prince of this world. What does the prince of this world mean? We saw the prince of Persia, but what could it possibly mean that he's the prince of this world? So should we keep going with this?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the same title? I'm trying to say if it's Archon. Is that the same title that's given to him in Ephesians 2, the prince of the power of the air?
No, I don't think that it is.
It is Archon.
Is there Archon there?
It's the Archon of the power of the air.
Well, there you go. Another bad translation. Well, no, it does say the prince of the power of the air.
It says the prince, not the ruler. Yeah,
it does.
Well, in the ESV, it does. I don't know what it says in the other one.
So it's great. So there you have the princes that's connecting to this divine council idea of Daniel chapter 10 and the princes over the nation. So if you're going to ask the question, where does Satan get all his power from? You need to, first of all, understand the New Testament context. What is the world power in the time of Jesus? Well, it's Rome, right? They're the world power. They've taken over Greece. Who took over the Medes and Persians, who took over the Babylonians, who took over the Assyrians, and so on, right? So, Rome. Well, who's the high god of Rome?
Mm-mm.
It's Jupiter. Okay, Jupiter means god father. So, he is who a Roman would tell you is the prince of Rome, Jupiter. Well, where did Jupiter come from? So there's this thing that happens when these ancient cultures go into another culture, that they would take over that culture's gods, and then they would assume them as their own and give them a new name. Jupiter comes straight from Zeus. So in fact, if you go look up the Wikipedia for either Zeus or Jupiter, you'll see that the Roman equivalent is, or the Greek equivalent is, Zeus is Jupiter. They're the exact same thing. So when the Romans took over the Greeks and their culture, they appropriated the high god of the pantheon of Greece, Zeus, and all the other gods too of the pantheon. They renamed them, and then they became the gods of Rome, because they're taking over the powers that allowed them to be the powers. It's kind of a kind of the thing that's going on there. Why in the world would that matter? Well, so there's this really crazy verse in Revelation chapter 2. And it talks about Satan's throne, and it's talking to the church at Pergamum. I know where you live, where Satan's throne is. And you're like, okay, that's great. Satan's throne. Why is Satan's throne in Pergamum? Why couldn't you say that it's everywhere else too? Why would you say that it's only in Pergamum? What in the world is John even talking about there? How does that even make sense? Satan's throne. So when you do a little digging, what you find is that there was actually a giant altar. And when I say giant, I mean it's the size of a house. And this altar was actually called the Altar of Zeus. And this altar was in Pergamum. And actually, during World War II, and this is a whole crazy, like, crazy thing, dude. They actually, the Nazis went to Pergamum to take this altar and bring it back to Berlin. And they made an entire museum out of this altar. I think they call it Zeus's altar museum, or it's something like that. I can't remember exactly what it is. Even crazier is that they had Hitler reenact a ceremony on this throne as he's kind of becoming the high power of, you know, wanting to usher in his Fourth Reich. Even crazier, when Obama was inaugurated, they reenacted the exact same thing, putting a duplicate of Zeus's altar and the whole deal, and they had him become the president in the exact same way that Hitler did with Zeus's altar.
No way.
Totally true story.
Now I gotta go research this.
So, why does this matter? Well, it's because Zeus's altar is what John is referencing when he talks about Satan's throne. It's the same thing. In other words, John is identifying Satan with Zeus. They're the same entity. Now, all of a sudden, people freak out about this because
big time.
They're like, well, Zeus isn't real. Are you saying Zeus is real? And I turn around and I go, well, Satan's real. Don't you believe Satan's real? Yeah, I believe Satan's real. I don't have a problem with that. But you're saying Zeus is real? He's a god and gods are idols. They don't exist. What I'm telling you is that Satan is Zeus. Now, you need to connect the dots in your own head to figure out what that means for you, I guess. But this is what we're saying. Now, think about why this matters. Because if Zeus is Jupiter, and Jupiter is the god of Rome, and Rome is the world power at the time, suddenly we have an explanation for why Satan can offer Jesus all the kingdoms of the world. It's because they're his. Why? Mm-hmm. Because he's the prince of Rome.
Hmm. So when Jesus is standing before, this just sounds funny to people when they're going to hear it, but when Jesus is standing before Satan, he's standing before Zeus, is what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Man, it gets even weirder.
Well, bring it. Let's go.
If we want to talk about Old Testament. Now, I have a paper on academia that I uploaded, a couple of years ago that I called,
is it Satan, Zeus, Baal?
Satan, Zeus, Baal, and the Prince of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Where I go through a couple more steps than what we'll talk about here with a fellow named Samael, who doesn't appear in the New Testament, but Samael is he's a equivalent figure of Zeus and Satan and all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually identified as the Prince of Rome, specifically by the Jews of that day. Mm-hmm. He's called the Prince of Rome. So that just kind of adds an extra piece into this thing. But at the end of the day, what we're mostly interested in for this show is helping people understand that, in fact, he is in the Old Testament, because we can go one step farther back than Greece and Zeus. We can go to the Canaanites and Baal in the Old Testament. So who did the Canaanites worship? Well, they worshiped Baal. All you have to do is read just about any story in Kings to find that out, and to find out the syncretism that Israel had with the Baals. Now, there's more than one Baal, so Baal just basically means Lord, but
Lord, yeah.
there was a high Baal, if you want to call him that, and he's the one who the Baal cycle is about, and this is the one who becomes the god of their pantheon, of the sons of God. He's the one that ends up ruling through the Baal cycle.
So Baal is used like Elohim then.
In what way?
Well, Elohim can mean the Most High God, or it can mean the gods. So Baal can mean lords, multiple lords.
It can do that. The only difference is that you don't find, unlike Elohim, where God or the gods can be called Elohim, you never find God being called Baal. That never happens. Even though he is Lord, and you could do that if it was merely a title, the Old Testament never ever calls the Lord God Baal. Always called Yahweh.
So it would be a pagan version of Lord then.
It would be, but it's not just a pagan version. What it is it's a usurper of Yahweh. So what you need to do is you need to distinguish then between the sons of God. So you have a Yom or Nahor, or Baal, or in the Israelite worldview, Yahweh is the son of God. Now, there's two Yahwehs. I think we've talked about that before, too. The idea that the father and son are one, and that there's a son who goes by Yahweh. He's the angel of Yahweh. The Old Testament does this so that we know that Yahweh is not Baal. They're not the same son of God. They're totally distinct, right?
That's good.
One is the creator of all, and he even created Baal, and the other one is a created entity, created by Yahweh.
Does the New Testament connect Baal to Satan?
The New Testament? I think it does, because when Jesus talks about overthrowing the strong man's house, that's actually strong man. That's language binding the strong man. Remember, Jesus says, I need to first bind the strong man. Well, this is the language John uses. In Revelation 20, of how Jesus bound Satan. So in other words, the strong man is Satan. Well, Jesus also says that, because he goes, how can Satan fight against his own kingdom? And at that very moment, they've been saying that you've been casting out demons by Beelzebub. Well, who's that? Well, it's a whole show you could do on Beelzebub and his name and stuff, but effectively it's Baal. So the New Testament is connecting Baal then to Satan, as it connects Zeus to Satan with Pergamum. And now what we're saying is that when the Greeks went into the Middle East, they took over Baal and they renamed Baal as Zeus. Zeus is Baal. Now all you have to do is go to the iconography and see that they're both the storm and lightning god. They're exact same thing. They function identical ways. The name of the mountain of Baal-Zephon became Zeus Cassius they renamed it that, because they're the same entity. So what this means is that all of a sudden this guy Baal, that we all grew up thinking, oh, he's just an idol, he doesn't exist, he's just
a golden
idol.
Calf, yeah,
that's all he is.
Yep,
actually he's Zeus, and actually Zeus is Jupiter, and actually Jupiter is Satan, so therefore Baal is Satan. And I'm not the first one that's proposed this. There's been lots of people that have talked about this. It just hasn't really made the rounds into pop culture or whatever, for whatever reason. And I'm trying to rectify that situation, because I want people to understand that we in fact do find Satan throughout the Old Testament as this chief adversary. Think of Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And what a mockery that is on this reenactment of a divine council on this divine mountain, you know, the Mount Carmel. And so we'll see whose God is God. And the whole thing is just a mockery of who Baal actually is. And that's why it's so great, because suddenly the mockery is so much more fun, because if he's a real entity, Now, this isn't, of course, he's better than Mickey Mouse. God, everybody knows God is better than Spider-Man because Spider-Man doesn't exist. But if he's real, if he is the one who all these cultures have reappropriated and said is the high God, and yet he has no power whatsoever compared to the Lord, that's powerful, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, and which is going to be leading us into, sorry, the scene that I had in my mind. Remember that scene in, I don't remember which Marvel movie it was, but where the Hulk grabs Loki and just kind of starts slapping him all over.
Puny God. Yeah. The first Avengers movie, I think that was.
Yeah, that's what it is. Just like whack, 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 whack. That's the scene where it's kind of like, oh, so you worship Baal. Let me show you what I do with Baal.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me mock him. Okay, so this is a little bit of a lead-in. What Doug and I are trying to do is these weird passages in the Old Testament where they're prophesying, like Psalm 24, which we're going to get into next. They're not strange just because David was hard to understand. There is a encouraging, redefining, and rebuilding our faith in what these psalms are doing. So in Matthew 12, 25, I want to make the connection for you here. This is what we're trying to get to, is that the Satan in the Old Testament and the Satan in the New Testament is the same being, but at times they come by different entities and different names. Therefore, it forces you to come to realizing that what you thought was an idol, a golden calf named Baal, was actually a real being, a created being, okay? It's not equal with God. And the purpose of Psalm 24 is to prove that he's not equal with God. But let me read this to you so you can hear Jesus' own words. This is Matthew 12, 25, and we'll pick this up next week. Knowing their thoughts, he said to them, every kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and no city or house divided against itself will stand. Because they were accusing him of casting out demons by the power of Baal, of the power of Beelzebub. So then he says this, Matthew 12, 26. And if Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? And if I cast out demons by, he then uses his Old Testament title, Beelzebub, all right? Which is this compound word. It can have a lot of different translations. Prince Baal, Lord of the Flies is one of them.
Lord of the Flies, Lord of the House. Lord of the House is interesting because in that one, he's actually plundering his house. And so that should be why he's called Beelzebub there.
That's right. So Jesus has
I had one more thing too, because this is fun.
Yeah.
Zeus is actually called Lord of the Flies.
There you go.
So there you go.
So I know some of it you're like, I'm still not convinced that Zeus is Satan. So we'll get there. Stay with us. But the connection I wanted to make for you is that I can't tell you how many times people have read the Gospels and over and over and over again, and then they come to me and they go, I never paid attention that he gives the title of Satan in verse 26, and then he gives the same entity, same person, same being, I should say, he gives it the same title as Beelzebub, which is Baal of the Old Testament.
Right.
And what Jesus is doing there is telling you this is a real being, and they're saying you're... Because it's blasphemy is what they're doing. It's total blasphemy. Jesus is proving he is the Lord. He is God. And they're saying, you're not using God's power. You're using Baal's power. And these Pharisees believed in Baal's power. That's the argument we're trying to make. Because once you understand this, oh man, the Bible opens up a lot. So Psalm 24 is very much about this battle, this war between God and Baal. And so we're going to open it up for you next week. It's a lot of fun. We already did the descent of Christ into hell with First Peter. So we'll give you a little bit of a tip. Psalm 24 and First Peter are very much connected in what they're trying to do. One is a prophecy towards something, and one is an encouragement from the past looking, or from the future, or from the past looking back. So if we've thoroughly confused you, then just come back next week. That's how we do advertising here. Anyways, we're gonna move on. We'll see you guys next week.